really terrible at training. I'm one of those people that sets a goal and then about, you know, 6 weeks out goes, oh, I better do something about this. So I didn't train on sand at all. I did lots of running, trail running, but I didn't train on sand. And I don't know, it was just fine. I mean, my calves hurt, but they will after 165 kilometres.
Kia ora tato. That was Fran McEwen. I'm Matt Raymond.
And I'm Eugene Bingham.
This is Dirt Church Radio. Interesting conversations with interesting runners. I've been spending so much time, digitally anyway, at the Filson Library. And I found a library that I prefer to be in, which is the Wild Things Library.
Yeah. Again. Have you been, like, down there to Mel's place, Mel and Sally's place, and, like, sitting in the Wild Things Library?
In the hand-tooled leather chairs smoking cigars. No, I haven't, but I've been making... if you sign up to Wild Things, the VIP membership, you enter the code DCR2021. It's really cool. You get 15 months, price of 12. We know that. We get a little bit of ooh-la-la.
Yep.
They're happy. Mm-hmm. You're happy.
Because you get the extra 3 months.
You get the three months. You can do the trail challenges. You can sign up for that. The Autumn Auckland one.
Get discounts at the store.
Absolutely. Really good discounts at the store. But you also get these sick emails with library articles.
Yeah.
It's not library articles. I mean, you don't borrow them. But it's stuff that you can read. So they go through and they collate. And there's lots of things in there from the sort of the useful for nine new tips for new runners or nine tips for new runners to the Sublime, which is the Riverhead Backyard Relapse link to us.
DCR special.
DCR special.
Yeah.
You know, post-run stretching, going far, going faster, Dean Karnazes is
in there. It's like the Smithsonian of trail running.
Absolutely.
Basically, they collect everything that's great and good about trail. Because you can get overwhelmed, you know.
Yes.
You just get,
absolutely,
so
you can.
But here you go. You just go to one place in Wild Things, in the VIP lounge, hang out, take up a chair, and you can read through some of the... best stuff that's being written and said about trail running all around the world too.
Absolutely. Just
it's so cool.
Don't reference the Wild Things Library for your pathophysiology exam. They don't like it.
Don't do that. Use the code DCR2021. So you just go along to wildthings.club.nz, sign up as a VIP member if you haven't, using that cool code, and away you go.
Ooh la la.
Read away.
You know that boat that jammed into the Suez Canal?
Yes.
The Ever Given.
Yes.
Which had Evergreen on the side, which was really confusing. But it was full of Ultra Spire Zygos 4-packs.
And that's destined for Aotearoa.
Destined for Aotearoa. And that's why there's been a hold-up. I mean, you could make a comment on the fragility of global supply lines, but all we need to know is that there is a ton.
I'm doing jazz hands.
Jazz hands.
I'm excited.
Yep. Decimal point commas of Zygos 4s back in stock in the Ultra Spire store, and if you go to ultraspire.co.nz, you will find said pack, 14 litres, great for a day out, great for a big day in the hills, all the gear you need. Eugene and I both use them, and they're fantastic. Ultraspire.co.
With the little cell phone
with
patch.
With the cell phone pack. Yeah.
Pouch thing. Man, it's like having a little baby koala.
Yeah, less mucus. Less mucus, generally, than, you know, they don't have a quacker either, but just, they're good.
They're real good.
Ultraspire.co.nz.
The other thing that's real good, the Food That Fastest store in Christchurch.
They are bloody good. They just sponsored the Mount Oxford Odyssey, which turned on the weather. But
gosh, you needed some gear from Further Faster
absolutely.
For that race.
Montane gear. that looked really, really bad.
You could have carried a kayak on top of your head and pull that snow off.
Absolutely. If you had a dog with you, you could have carried that dog.
Yes.
Roughly. Rambling aside, they've got the best stuff.
They do.
And they really know said stuff, and they're passionate about said stuff. Mm-hmm. I understand they're getting the beer reviews back up and down, and they're an essential part of the community. So if you go to furtherfaster.co.nz, the best little independently owned outdoor store in Aotearoa.
Or if you're in Christchurch or Te Tahi, pop into the store and make sure you are singing this song.
It goes something like further, faster, there in Christchurch. Rocky is hairy and so is Badger. Jules is nice and Jacob is delicious. Go to further, faster now.
Oh, further, faster, there in Christchurch. Rocky is hairy and so is Badger. Jules is nice and Jacob is delicious. Go to further, faster now.
Church Radio.
Episode 140.
We made it.
We did.
We're really getting up there.
We are.
We've got canon.
We have.
We've got tenure.
Tons of stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We had another long weekend too.
We did.
There's been a lot.
21 years of not having long weekends, and I've had more long weekends than I've had in the last 21 years. And I tell you, I'm a fan of them, eh? I like a bank holiday weekend.
Yep. They're good. They're good. We got some more good running in the bank.
Oh, so good.
Great run in the forest.
Perfect run in the forest. And it was Anzac weekend.
Yes.
And how cool was it, the most talented member of Dirt Church Radio, Andrew McDowell, playing the bugle at the Anzac Day Dawn Service again?
He's a talented fella, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. Really,
yeah.
Like he said to me at Relapse, oh, I brought my bugle. And I had to kind of check and go, no, he's got a bugle, eh? Yeah, no, he can't play.
And it's a OG, it's a World War II one.
Yeah, it's a World War II bugle.
I read somewhere, found it at Dunkirk.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's got some history.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was also a busy weekend of racing and cool adventures for plenty of people.
Yeah, absolutely. See, Brooke Van Reenen.
Yeah.
Got an epic mission at Gillespie's Pass. Mate. Yeah, old mate Brooke. Pretty gnarly conditions.
Mm. Got it done. Yeah, and heaps of people seem to have fun at Root Burn as well.
Absolutely. I mean, 3 years.
I know.
3 years, 2 years of weather, 1 year of COVID.
Yeah.
And,
because it got like washed away, didn't it?
It washed away 1 year and then snow the next and then virus and then the year
pandemic.
Before. Yep. The year this last year. And then.
Do you know?
Yes.
How much. Sorry, it's a tangent here. Just thinking of washed away. And
we've never done that.
Do you know? We've never taken it. Let me just take it. We've been 140 episodes. Give us a bit. How much COVID, actual virus, there is in the world at any one time? Like if you got it all together.
Like a thimble?
Half a wine glass.
Huh.
There you go. Anyway, interesting thing I heard. I think we should get back on track. Some amazing wash up to the Riverhead Backyard Relapse last week. Some cool feedback about the show we did.
Yes, that was really cool. I loved that episode.
Yeah.
I loved that.
It was fun.
It was really cool.
Mm. See, Chris Bisley has said he can't go to Tennessee, which is understandable.
Absolutely.
With travel restrictions and family and stuff.
But absolutely.
It would be great to see him toe the line there one day.
Yeah, but Adam Keane and Katie Wright and maybe even Will Hayward are potentially in the mix, but totally understand that.
Yeah.
You know, Chris, and I guess it's not even the getting over there, it's the getting back and then having to go to America for another 2 weeks. That would be.
And also because you're not sure how long you're going to be there.
Yeah.
You know?
True.
So you can just put in leave for 3 days.
Moana Pool's not going to run itself.
No, that's right. Exactly. Yeah.
Mike White, what a G. He came through with that Sunday Star Times piece and it was incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, we were talking about yesterday, how it gave us some good insight into the motivations and pressure and understood Sam Harvey a bit more.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. Mm. Absolutely. Mm. Like he was 100% in it to win it. And I thought it was really lovely. He took the rocks from Frozen Head Park and brought them back.
Yeah, so check that out if you haven't read it. In fact, we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's a digital link on stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. So this week, Fran McEwen.
Wow.
Where do you even start?
We've just had the conversation with Fran. She is the founder of the Shift Foundation and advocate for which is foundation focused on co-producing programs to encourage advocacy for the well-being of young women in Aotearoa. She left home at 16. She talks about that very openly. She said it was a multi sort of factorial thing. And she says she made some, her words, pretty poor decisions, her life decisions that affected her mental health. But at age 25, wanting to quit smoking and lose some weight, she went back into running, which she used to love doing. And she's had some pretty amazing adventures.
Amazing adventures. And we talk about all of that. And, you know, she's gone on, she now sort of helps young women get active and find their own way through, both through the Shift Foundation and through her role at Sport New Zealand. She's a Blake Leadership Medal recipient and amazing, amazing conversation. You'll love it.
And she works for Sport NZ in a role to get young people out being active. I mean, they don't be handing those Blake Leadership Medals out like candy or anything.
No, they do not. Hey, look, so you'll love that conversation. But look, don't forget our upcoming event this week. If you're listening on Wednesday,
we're getting
it's
back
on tomorrow. If you're listening on Thursday, it's on like tonight. And if you're listening on Friday, you missed it. Sorry about that.
You have to wait till Wednesday. But yeah, we're getting out Thursday, 29th of April. We're recording a live show at the Halatau Tap House on Karangahape Road in central Auckland. And we're talking to three of the amazing people from Sports Lab, which we've talked about before. It's like it's a rehab and injury prevention hub and it has a multidisciplinary focus. So we're talking injury prevention, treatments, you know, if you're not crying when you're foam rolling, are you doing
it
right? All of that sort of stuff. And we'll be there too, you know, so sort of tangenting around. But three people who really know what they're talking about would be Luke McCallum, who's a previous DCR guest, a massage therapist, Vaughan Craddock, who's a physiotherapist, and Laurel Abel, who's a podiatrist. And get here, there's 6:30 for a 7 p.m. start. It's going to be fun and informative, and it's free.
Yep.
So roll up.
To hang out with some mates and listen to.
And Karangahape Road rules.
Yeah.
You know.
It does. It does.
So there we go.
Very good relationship. How have you been, man?
I've been great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, back on my straps, eh?
Yeah.
Which is really good finally sort of get. So, running, I mean, again, running, uni, work, life. but getting some good training in. Amazing run in the Forestland with you on Sunday. Mm. It was just perfect. And, you know, Harry and Tom and Ben on Saturday. So, yeah, cup's pretty full at the moment, I must say. Just what I needed. What about you, man?
Yeah, Katie Horta. Busy week again. Got out on my last long run pre-Rotorua marathon on Saturday. Hooked up with Tom and Jean, which is always fun.
Yeah.
Some good laughs. Even managed a quick dip in the sea afterwards. How good is that when you do that?
Yeah, like going impromptu swims are the best.
Yeah. A little bit chilly, but it was nice. So Tom and I are going to be pacing the 4-hour group at Rotorua. It was going to be 3:45, but I'm actually quite relieved that it's 4 now.
Yeah.
And after that, I'll be looking forward to getting in some solid trail and hill work before Wutu K.
It's amazing that people, like, we ran into someone in the forest day and he's like, and one of you is doing the Rotorua Marathon.
Yeah.
That's Eugene.
I'm the one with the beard.
Yeah.
You're the one usually with. No, you don't, because you don't run with glasses, so that's understandable.
No.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, that'll be fun. I'm looking forward to it. But I am looking forward to getting back into some serious trails. Yeah. Patreon patrons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you like what we do and you want to support us, come on board. If you set up a regular donation, even for the cost of a cup of coffee a month or a one-off cup of coffee, it would help us to do things that are a bit outside our reach, buying audio equipment to improve our sound quality, getting to more races.
Zoom.
We had our first DCR Zoom.
Fran was our trial. No, she wasn't our trial.
It was amazing.
Help
us keep the lights on, basically. And we really appreciate those who contribute, and we really appreciate you if you were to consider to contribute, or if you're not considering to contribute, we appreciate you as much as we appreciate everyone else.
The whole lot of you.
Yeah. Hit the red button. Stop this madness.
God, we're so good at this. Right, before we get into the races and things, Glenn Sutton, man of amazing missions, he's got an amazing mission coming up.
It sounds just so brutal, eh? Like the stuff that Glenn Sutton does is brutal. So going on Thursday, May 6th, he's running from Milford Sound in Fiordland to Mount Cook, Aorangi Mount Cook, to raise money for the Otago Community Hospice.
Mm.
It's around about 580 kilometres on the road. It'll be his longest run ever, and it'll take about 4 days. And he'll have some running club friends taking in and out his company, but it's going to take him over some serious country and serious hills.
Yeah, that is no joke.
Yeah, it is no joke. Glenn Sutton's no joke. We'll put a link in the show notes and look forward to hearing how he gets on.
Do you think he takes out a map and he goes, Hauraki Plains, not too flat.
Hang on. I think he's like the Terminator.
Yeah.
Just him and his hot water bottle. I mean, that's it too, you know, like, remember he had the hot water bottle, he broke his pelvis, still got bad water.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yep. And for hospice is such a, and I mean, gosh, what an amazing service they provide.
Absolutely. We'll put a link in our show notes and look forward to hearing how he gets on. Go, you good thing. Right. Speaking of good things, Root Bean Classic.
Yeah, everyone's favourite trail, it seems. It's been a while.
Yeah.
3 years off.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about it before. It was great to see this epic run back on. Mm. And it, again, Fjordland weather didn't play around, did it? It started off really fun. You saw the front runners and they're in T-shirts and stuff, and then you saw the people sort of mid-pack and they're in all their compulsory gear because it was snowing.
Yeah, compulsory gear plus, wasn't it?
Yikes.
Yeah, it looked, it got pretty cold up there, but everyone was smiling.
Yeah, absolutely. So Sarah Douglas of Queenstown, 3:26.14. Dana Hunter, 3:36.15 for second, and Maureen Stankiewicz, 3:45.03.
Awesome, Sarah. And go back and have a listen to our interview with her earlier in the year.
And she's a graphic designer.
She is. Yeah. She was one of the originals. So, hey, just quickly too, Maureen, six races this summer, six podiums, including five wins.
That's amazing.
Not a bad summer's work.
Not a bad summer's work at all.
Right, Craig Fowler, 2:52.01. Martin McCrudden, 2:59.15. And Huel Dinnick, 3:01.33.
Nice. Theirs. Yeah. It's incredible. So the
Oparara Wilderness.
Oparara Wilderness,
In the Kahuranga National Park, which is on the west coast. And that must be like running through dinosaur land, isn't it? You go through rainforest, gravel, sealed roads, 35 million year old limestone caves.
Wow.
Arches and channels. Pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
The 36K run and a 20K run too. So Hilary Bristow took out the win in 4:05.36, Kathy Richardson 4:21.31, and Michelle Black in 4:30.17.
And in the men's, Vajan Armstrong 2:47.51, Silas Carey 2:55.42, Lewis Schindler 3:02.47. How stacked is that field?
It's stacked as hell.
Whoa. And course record for Vajan.
Yeah.
How many of those do you reckon he's got and podium finishes in his career?
I mean, just solid. Solid. And that's a solid, that's a mighty pack.
Yeah.
The 20K, Katie Smith in 1:51.22, Tracy Evans in 2:05.52, and Kelly Lilly in 2:09.55.
And in the men's 20K, Ben Williams 1:29.19, Hayden Squance 1:35.49, and Sam Mowat 1:43.41. Look, and finally, it's not Aotearoa, but amazing run at the weekend. And we took this from iRunFar's excellent coverage, as always. Lithuania's Alexander Sorokin, he set a new world record, two new world records actually, 11:14.56 for the 100-mile world record, and a distance of 105.825 miles or 170.309 kilometres for the 12-hour world record. And that was at the Centurion Running Track 100-mile in England. They're both world records for all surfaces, I'm not sure, just surfaces. So his mark beats the previous record of 11:19.18 for 100 miles and 104.88 miles for 12 hours, which were both set by Zach Bitter, another previous DCR guest, at the 6 days in the Dome Race in Wisconsin. So Sorokin, if you don't know, he's got a long history with road and track ultra running, including a 10th place at the 100K World Champs in 2015, a win at Spartathlon in 2017, and a win at the 2019 24-hour World Champs. So his 100-mile split is 4 minute 12Ks.
It's quite impressive.
That's impressive.
If you had that at Parkrun, you'd be like, that's good, I had a good run.
Yeah. Well, that's sub 3 hour marathons.
Four sub 3 hour marathons.
Four of them in a row.
As you do.
Yeah.
I mean, gosh, Zach, he lost his world record, but he bagged a win and course record at the US 100-mile champs held at the Jackpot 100 in Las Vegas with 12:52.14. Stephanie Philippin took the win and course record of 14:31 in the women's. Second was Camille Heron in 14:42. And, oh, my gosh, Micah Regan Morgan was third in 14:44. All three.
Under course record time.
Amazing.
That's so good. And there were a few other races in the US over the weekend.
Which is good to see, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good to see.
Including some Golden States Western tickets.
Yep, Golden States Western tickets up for grabs.
Western States Golden tickets were up for grabs in the Canyons 100 in California. So, yeah, great to see those races getting back up and going. Ruth Croft raced in Sydney over the weekend in a marathon, DNF'd, but said she was aiming for 2:29:30. It didn't quite come into plan. Everything's got to line up to get a time like that, and didn't work out for her that day. But she was pretty stoked to be heading back to the trails.
Yeah.
And that's going to be interesting to see how she gets on at Western States. So, on your oath. Right.
Greatest run ever, which is the part of the show where we ask you to write in and tell us about your greatest run ever. It doesn't have to be that time you ran 2:29 a marathon or a race or a mountain summit. It might just be a run around the block.
What about if you set a 100-mile world record?
Yeah, it might be that time.
Send it in, Alexander. Yeah.
Day one, I ran 100 miles. Then what did you do for the rest of the day? Hang out?
It's not even a whole day. No. Just over 11 hours.
No, and then I did my laundry. Anyway, something that sung to you for some reason, send it in to us at dirtchitchradio@gmail.com. And look, before we start this, just be aware that this greatest run ever contains a reference to suicide. This is from Kimberly Gilmore, and I quite often thought that doing the Kepler Challenge would be my greatest run ever, and it was, but for quite different reasons than I would have imagined. By the time I got to the start line in 2020, I'd been wanting to do this run for about 12 years. When I first heard about it, I was fit and relatively young, 30. I'd just done the Motutapu Marathon. I was training for Coast to Coast. I loved tramping, and I was excited by the idea of running a great walk. Unfortunately, though, I missed out on an entry at the time, and then I guess the momentum dropped away along with that level of fitness. Life rolls on. I changed jobs, moved cities, and I didn't have my crew of running buddies nearby anymore. I didn't stop running, but in the years that followed, it became very much more of a pleasant hobby than an athletic pursuit. Some years down the road, I met an intelligent, funny, kind, gentle man. His name was Angus, and we started to build a life together. Much of the time, things were great, but at times they were pretty hard too. Angus struggled with depression and anxiety. It was a lifelong battle, and one he fought incredibly hard to overcome. It still hurts to say this, at the beginning of 2018, Angus took his own life. Losing Angus broke my heart. For many months, I wasn't sure if or how I'd get through the day. The grief, the sadness, the intense feelings of guilt and regret, the numbness, the tears, the meaninglessness of everything else. It was only with the unwavering love and support of friends and family that I was able to hang in there. During challenging times in the past, I turned to running, but this time I wasn't able to. Even on days that I have enough energy to want to run, my heart rate shot through the roof minutes after getting started. It seemed like my heart was broken in more ways than one. I felt like running would help me cope emotionally, but my body wasn't responding, so frustration was another emotion to add to the list of all the tough ones. In time, I started to re-engage more with life, and a little over a year after I lost Angus, I moved back to Auckland, started a new job, and spent more time with friends, both old and new. I was feeling much stronger mentally and emotionally, but I still couldn't run without my heart rate spiking. After trying a while to fix it myself by just running through, I finally went to a coach, and with a mix of slowing right down and introducing more tempo runs, things started to come right. I was soon able to run regularly and comfortably again, and it felt really good. And then, you know, 2020 happened with COVID and all the uncertainty and restrictions that came along with it. It was also around this time that a lovely man, Mike, came into my life with his beautiful daughter, Georgia, and their crazy but awesome little dog. 2020 said a lot of wonderful my way, but let's be honest, there was also quite a bit of shitty stuff that we all had to contend with. I was relieved that I was now able to get out for runs, to get some moments of freedom, and to help process and navigate the many and varied feelings that I was having. It was somewhere in amongst all this that doing the Kepler Challenge popped back into my mind. I started off just increasing one run a week by a single kilometre, and soon enough I was comfortably able to run 20 kilometres plus. In July, I was lucky enough to get an entry to the Kepler Challenge, but honestly, 60 kilometres seemed almost laughingly impossible. I'd heard Brad Dixon on this podcast some time before, and I liked the idea of his approach to training. I contacted Brad, and under his guidance, I increased my kilometres and built up my strength and stamina. Brad's philosophy really worked for me. It wasn't all about numbers and times. It was about training efficiently, keeping the joy of running, and preserving time and energy and other important parts and people of my life. Mike and Georgia were really encouraging of my running, often joining me on trails, including entering some exterior events, and it was nice to feel so supported. On the 5th of December 2020, I completed the Kepler Challenge. It was the alternative course, so you know I will still have to go back and run the original route. On that day, I had the enthusiastic support of Mike, and some good friends were in the race as well. I wore Angus's Garmin watch when I was tired, thinking of him gave me strength. The course allowed us to see fellow runners and supporters several times throughout the course, which lifted my spirits. At about the 40k mark, I came across a fellow runner cheering and high-fiving the other competitors. His energy and support made me smile. I caught up to him, and we ran together for a few kilometres, traversing a range of topics, both deep and light. And so stepping out of this, that runner was me. And Kimberly goes on to say, and our interaction gave me an even bigger energy hit than any of the caffeinated gels I was on by this time. I reached the end with an aching body, some quiet tears and a big smile. I'll never know what it would have been like to have run the Kepler 12 years earlier. Almost undoubtedly, I would have been faster and less sore, but I don't think it would have been as much of an achievement. It wasn't just me that got to the start line of Kepler 2020, and it definitely wasn't just me that got to the finish.
Wow. Kimberly, thank you. That is one of, yeah, that's, we started Greatest Run Ever wondering what people would send to us, and honestly, we're just constantly blown away by what people do. Thank you, Araha Nui. And yeah, I don't even know what to say.
There's not much to say.
No.
Thank you. And it was a powerful moment. I mean, thank you. We've talked about it in the past, haven't we? It, yeah. It was a powerful moment.
Yeah.
Then
it was it was a powerful moment for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you listen to that Kepler special, we did talk about it.
Yeah.
And it's a powerful.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we talked about it explicitly, did we?
No, we didn't. I wasn't referred anywhere.
To it, and that's kind of and that's the backstory to it. So,
yeah.
Kimberly, thank you. The rest of you, send them in to us.
Yeah.
People love them, and you can see why. And you can read them on the website as well, and people do that. So, yeah, send them in. Right. Talk about amazing wahine.
Yeah,
Fran McEwen. Yeah, it's hard to know where to start. She's someone who gets things done. She's an ultra marathon runner. But if you'd said to her, you know, her teenage self, she'd probably have laughed at you. Although she does say that she liked running 1,500 metres back then.
I so love
there
you go. That.
Yeah,
that is a good moment. It's a great kind moment. Of,
She experienced what many teenagers did, drift away from school, activity and home life. But she found her way back. And she not only lives out what she would once never have dreamed of, she helps others achieve it too, especially young women. She's the founder of the Shift Foundation, a globally recognised organisation dedicated to helping young women. She works at Sport New Zealand in the recreative team. I don't know. And she's a Blake leader and an inspiration to so many people. So she joins us to talk about all of that and her amazing adventures. Without further ado, Fran McEwen. Church Radio.
From Wellington, we are very privileged to be joined by Fran McEwen. Fran, kia ora, how are you going?
Kia ora, I'm going really well, thank you. How are you going?
Yeah, really well. And we were talking about it before we came online, but this is the first time that we've ever done a Dirt Church Radio, both of us, Zoom call.
Yeah, we're breaking new ground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Reliance. Yay, I'm so glad to be part of you breaking new ground.
I was relying on Skype and the facsimile for too long.
Yeah, yeah, dragged into the 21st century. Comes.
Congratulations. Dirt Church Radio. Welcome.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank
2021.
You.
Oh, it's Cleary here.
Yeah, that's such high definition.
Yeah. So, you, I mean, we wanted to sort of go right back to the beginning if we could with you. And it's appropriate because you're actually at your childhood home, is that right?
I am, yes.
Oh. So just can you tell us about growing up? So you grew up sort of near the river with quite a quintessential Kiwi lifestyle by the sounds of it.
I did. Yep, I'm a 80s child, and I feel like was very lucky to have that, I guess, that upbringing where I could walk to primary school. I had, you know, a family dog. My mum didn't work. My dad was a sports producer for TVNZ, so he was a busy man and worked, and mum was a home mum, so I feel very lucky. Grew up really close to nature, swimming a lot in Te Awa Kairangi, the beautiful river that runs through Upper Hutt. Really active and outdoorsy sort of, yeah, childhood, which I feel very grateful for.
Because there's a lot of bush. And describe the Hutt Valley for people who aren't familiar with it.
I'll start by saying Upper Hutt, which is where I'm born and bred, has a bit of a bad rep sometimes. People, you know, when I proudly say that I'm from Upper Hutt, people go, oh, really? But I really embrace the fact that I'm from Upper Hutt, and probably because it is so close to green space. So the Hutt Valley is obviously a valley, so there's beautiful trails and places to run and green space on both sides up the valley, and really close to the Tararuas, so great to be able to go tramping and walking in there, just surrounded by beautiful native bush.
When I first moved to Aotearoa, the first place that I lived, or the first place that we lived, was Wainuiomata. And same thing, gets a terrible rep, right? Like people, and we used to go over to Lower Hutt. I remember being astounded coming from a really industrial city in the United Kingdom to this space, which was so green and the water, you know, you got the hill, you see the coast and everything like that, Kapiti Island, everything. It was just fantastic. So I get that sense too of just how, despite people's perceptions, how lovely the place actually is.
Yeah, it really is. And I love that feeling. I love to travel. So COVID's been a pain not getting to go on these overseas adventures. But yeah, I always love that feeling of coming back into, like, just as getting out of Wellington and you start coming into the Hutt Valley and the hills are right there and you can see the Tararuas in the distance and driving along next to the river on the motorway. And it's just really beautiful and feels very much like home. So really great to be from this part of the country.
And what a childhood playground. You know, to have as your backyard.
Yeah, yeah.
And you mentioned your dad being a sports producer for television. So would he sometimes take you along to events and things?
Yeah, yeah. It was really privileged growing up getting to go to like the Goodwill Games in Seattle and just going on a lot of trips doing scoping work. So, you know, we'd be having meetings with the Asian Broadcasting Union. So we'd get to, you know, go to China for a month and just, yeah, lots of amazing adventures and trips. And yeah, just, I guess that's probably where I got my love from travel from as well, as from to do that from a really young age.
Yeah.
It was like the golden age of state broadcasting, really, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't even remember the Goodwill Games. What were they?
Yeah, great question. I just remember my mum standing up. I must have been maybe about 9, and I remember my mum standing up with a sign and just screaming at these cyclists in the velodrome, "Go the Kiwis!" And me just being so mortified at my mother. Yeah, so that's probably my only actual memory of being in the stadium or at an actual sport. But I do remember living in an apartment complex in Seattle and having a swimming pool and meeting all these kids that lived in this apartment complex as well. So it was much more about playing and making new friends when I was young than it was going to sporting events. Probably didn't care so much about those.
Yeah. So you had that kind of the background running around and the upbringing running around and that love of sports and travel, but you kind of fell out of love with sport, would it be fair to say, and things started to not go so well for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I was about probably maybe when I hit 12, sort of the end of intermediate. I mean, my mum always describes it as going off the rails, but hindsight now, I probably look back and think it was a combination of sort of undiagnosed mental health issues and hormones and being a teenager, you know, it's hard. But yeah, just started to, became really disengaged with sport, but any type of physical activity, started making really unhealthy lifestyle choices, I guess, like just wanting to drink and party and socialize. I didn't engage with the traditional education system. So I really hated school, probably pretty much just went to eat my lunch. Going from a really happy, kind of lovely, I guess, upbringing to quite difficult teenage years. Yeah.
How you described, you know, the traditional kind of thing is Fran's gone off the rails. That's such a catch-all term, isn't it? And then you described that actually it's a very subtle thing and it's made up of lots and lots of different factors and it's not necessarily about, oh, there was this sentinel trauma or something like that. It put you on the path you're on today, isn't it? Which is, I guess, why we've got you on and what we're really, really keen to talk about. You're working with young people and you're getting them active and you're growing your confidence, growing their confidence. And looking back on what you know now, can you see what put you on the path that you ended up going on? And I guess, what would your now self say to your then self?
Yeah, I... what would I say? I'd say to myself that it's all going to pan out just how it's supposed to, and so just roll with it and it'll be okay. I think part of the reason why it has turned out okay is probably because I had some really strong foundations. You know, I'm really grateful to my parents for being wonderful parents. We didn't speak a lot, and we had a pretty traumatic sort of that period of 10 years when I was a young person. But I had really solid foundations to go back to. And I always had this sense inside of deep self-belief, and that I probably knew I could do anything that I wanted to do with my life. I just didn't quite know what I wanted to do or who I was or where I was going. And it just took a lot of time to figure that out. But I started working with teenage girls when I was about 24. I was living in Adelaide. I lived in Adelaide for 5 years and ran a program out of a library and community centre, working with at risk. I'm doing the bunny ears thing at risk young women. And they were just young women like me who were still finding themselves. A lot of them were disengaged with the education system and had quite traumatic backgrounds. A couple of Aboriginal young women, a couple that came from pretty rough homes with drugs and alcohol, substance abuse. And I just realized that I had this deep empathy for them, and I could understand where they were coming from, and I was really patient with them. And, you know, their teachers and parents were really frustrated, and I was like, well, you know, there's a lot going on and they're amazing, and let's take a strengths-based approach to what they can do and what they want to do. And that was kind of my first foray into working with teenage girls, and just finally felt like I'd found my place. The program is actually called Finding My Place. And I found my place, as well as, I guess, supporting a lot of young women to sort of find their place in the world. I'm still friends with some of them on social media, and that's, I don't know, nearly 15 years ago. Wow. So it was a real life-changing experience for me, and was just the beginning of my, I guess, love of working with young people, but particularly young women.
Mm-hmm. That word patience is just, I mean, that's often the critical word, isn't it? And I know, you know, as parent self, being a teenager, you know, that is often just the key ingredient, isn't it? That let's just all take a breath. Let's just all, you know, be patient.
Yeah, I think I don't have children, so maybe it's easy for me to say this. And I always say that when I am talking to parents, but, you know, have such high expectations of young people, and they're still finding their way in the world. And I think if you just can put yourself back in the shoes of being a teenager again and remembering how hard it is and how much you feel bullied or judged, or, you know, your mental health is up and down and life is really difficult. And I think if you can put yourself back there and try and remember that and practice that empathy, it just puts you in a different frame of mind to think about, oh, it's hard being a young person, and let's have a bit more patience and empathy.
It's so important, isn't it? And you think about, you know, working, I guess, for me, being a parent, having been a teenager, and also having over the last 21 years, you know, worked with an incredible amount of young people. When you do approach with understanding and patience, it's that reward, isn't it? You just see they are like, you know, they might look all tough and cool, and, you know, we all don't know what the generation in front of us is doing and we don't really understand it, but they are so unfettered. There's such unfettered kindness and joy and curiosity and innocence in there. And I wonder if we take sort of a backwards approach to our children, like we hammer them with like school results, got to think about this, got to think about this, you got to do well academically, you got to do this. But then in terms of empathy, in terms of being actually a good, fallible human being, we don't really, it feels like sometimes that kind of isn't what, when do you pick that up? You know, if you don't learn it first, when do you actually pick it up?
Yeah, and if you don't have great role models around you, I guess, demonstrating what that looks like to live that way, then you only know what you know, right? So
You ended up studying sociology, and it was during that study that you researched the lived experience of teenage girls in sport and physical activity. You did some really in-depth interviews with some young women about why they dropped out of sport, one thing. So can you tell us about what you found out?
Yeah, I was working in park sport and recreation at Wellington City Council, and I was trying to find a way to work with teenage girls, as I do in all of my jobs. and so I was as well finishing my my adult education, my BA in sociology, and I kind of needed to, I guess, create a case for why we would focus on teenage girls in sort of park, sport and recreation, and had this little idea in the back of my head about starting some sort of project or program, but thought, oh, why not use this research paper that I have to do to try and find out a bit of the evidence behind why it's needed. So I talked to a diverse range of young women, different ages, different ethnicities, different lived experience. Some of them were super sporty and absolutely loved it, and some had been more like me where they had engaged in sport at a younger age and then dropped out of it because of, you know, a whole lot of different reasons. I guess what I found out is echoed by all of the research, and that's still coming out. You know, Sport New Zealand still got research coming out now that sort of explains the key differences between young women and young men and their participation levels. But a lot of it is around the psychosocial barriers that young women experience. So it's the body confidence or the perceived lack of ability. It's the juggle of NCEA and childcare duties as part of the whānau and all the other stuff going on. So busy lives, hard to motivate ourselves sometimes. And then, yeah, those psychosocial lack of confidence, body issues, which young men also have, but they seem to be more prevalent for young women. So it kind of backed up my own lived experience. So really in that amount of time, nothing had 20 years, nothing had actually changed. Mm. And I guess that was also the seed of why I wanted to do this work, was because it was like there's a whole lot of research and people keep researching and we do all these research and these interviews and we hear young people and they share their ideas and their voices, but no one actually does anything about it. And because I'm a get shit done kind of person, it was like, well, here's the research. We know this stuff. Now let's do something about it. And that was the birth of an idea that turned out to be SHIFT.
Mm. Tell us about SHIFT Foundation.
So the SHIFT Foundation is a charitable trust based in Wellington that aims to improve the well-being of young women. And our kaupapa is all around increasing physical activity or helping young women find ways of moving that really works for them and that they enjoy. Which could be sport, but it could also be yoga or trail running or going to the gym or just mucking around, playing games, whatever that looks like. And we also do a lot of programs around leadership, self-confidence, motivation, mindfulness. So they're really holistic well-being. So, yeah, focused on leadership, physical activity, but holistic well-being. And we co-design everything that we do. So all the programs that we design and deliver are created with young women, not for young women. So can very much take a strengths-based, needs-based approach and design initiatives and interventions that really work for young women.
Mm. And you
it's the best thing ever. I love it. It's just the best.
We can tell.
Good.
And you deliberately stay tightly focused rather than putting on like mass events and things. Do you want to tell us why you do that?
Quality over quantity, right? So youth workers, the closer they, so we have a lot of shift coordinators, essentially youth workers, the closer they are and the stronger the relationships are that they build with young women, the more likely they are to have that trusted sort of relationship where young women can talk to them about what's going on for them and you can help actually meet their needs and serve them. So it's just very much about, again, like co-design, but you can't co-design impactful and meaningful programs if you're working with 100 young women. So The smaller the group, the more the relationships build. The relationships build with the young women, so we're then working on social connectedness. Just very intentionally try to do things for smaller groups of young women and have greater impact rather than this kind of approach of like, you know, bigger is better and mass participation. And yeah, that's not really our jam. Mm.
I love the phrase you used to serve the young women. I think that's so important when you're providing, and in healthcare or whatever, you're providing service rather than this kind of philanthropic, I'm going to give this to you. And you should be grateful that I've given it, you know, like you're actually from that place of service. Mm. You know, you fell out of love with sport. You said that, you know, it was a multifactorial thing. 10 years later, you fell back in love. What was that process?
Oh, yeah, I often get asked about, like, how I got back into running. So I was actually always a really good runner. So I think one of those natural runners, whatever that means, whatever it is, we're all natural runners.
Not us.
But I think I was quite good at cross country when I was at primary school, and I always really enjoyed running. And even on athletics day, like I'd go down the alleyway and have a cigarette with my mates, and then I'd come back and run the 1500 meter on athletics day, like in the 2:2 or whatever. And so I always had this sort of love and of long distance running. So it was must have been it's innately in there, right? So this love of running has always been there. But I was trying to give up smoking when I was about 25. I was living in Adelaide, and I remember going and buying a new pair of running shoes and being like, I'll just do one round the block and then I'll have a cigarette. And so it just started like, I'll try and replace the smoking with running. And so that was really how I kicked the habit, although I went on and off smoking for the next, you know, 10 years. So it didn't actually fully work. But that was how I first started pick the shoes back up again when I was in my sort of mid-20s. And I guess had that experience that the more you do it, the better you get, the more rewarding it feels. So that was sort of the very beginning of getting back on the running sort of bandwagon. And yeah, it's just increased, I guess, over time to, and I think I haven't really talked about this, but I'm bipolar too. So I'm quite full on, so I'm quite a lot. I get called frantic often. Frantic, yeah. And so running has also been a way that's helped me be able to decrease my medication and also just look after my general mental health and well-being. So I think when I started maybe in my early 30s connecting the dots and realizing that this was a thing that actually really helped me take less medication and helped me really look after myself, I got more and more into it. And the long distance stuff just comes from having a lot of energy to burn, and so I would just go off on a run and then not come back for 30 kilometers. And yeah, so I've just, it's just been the most helpful thing for my mental health that I've, you know, that I ever found. And I only wish that I knew as a teenager, I guess, the benefits of physical activity and how I could have used that to probably help rather than push that away as one of the first things to go. But you live and learn.
Mm. You sure do. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the old thing, isn't it? We wish we'd known back then what we know now. I'm always intrigued when people either pick up running later on or come back to running. Why running? Why not, I don't know, standing in a field? Or, you know, like, what is it about running that you decided that's what I want to do? Initially, just help you stop smoking.
I don't actually think I've ever been asked that question. And I think my answer is probably multifaceted. I think, like I said, it was something, it feels like quite an innate thing for me to do, that it mm-hmm. was always a natural way of moving for me. So I'm sure that must play a part. I think the seeing the benefit on my mental health, like actually feeling the benefit of it, right, is probably another reason why I've kept going. Because I know it's the way that, it's the one thing that I do for myself. It's the one way I look after myself. So I think I've made that connection in my brain. So therefore, I'm only letting myself down if I don't go for a run. I think it's also the connection to nature, and that's the beauty of trail running. I did start running on the footpath, but it didn't take too long until I was, you know, in the bush. And I think, again, we know it's evidence that the connection to, you know, nature and green space and the benefit that that has on mental health as well. So I think a combination of those things. And I love that feeling. I feel like I've heard somebody else say this on one of your episodes, talking about the fact that running, probably the same with like mountain biking, that you can go to places that you can't go in a vehicle. And I love that sense of adventure that you get from being able to take your own body to a specific place and what you get to experience while being there, whether that's the view or whether that's just that wonderful feeling of having achieved something. I think probably a combination of all of those things are the reason why I call myself a runner.
Mm. And I mean, it's taken you to some, you know, you said you love traveling. It's taken you to some fantastic places. I mean, there's a race, and I've read about it before in other books, and it's a spectacularly, underwhelmingly named Oman Desert Marathon. It doesn't really kind of sum it up, does it? I mean, tell us about that.
Oh, that was just so incredible. The Omani people are just beautiful. I'm pretty sure that in my last life I was Middle Eastern, so I definitely feel most at home in the Middle East. I absolutely love it. And two of my bestest friends, one's Egyptian and one's Jordanian, so when I get to travel to the Middle East, I get to see some of my favourite people in the world. But I did the yes, you're right, very stupid name, Oman Desert Marathon, when it's just
underwhelming, isn't it? It's like they could bump it up a bit. I mean, they're not going to be accused of, you know, overhyping it, are they?
No, but it's a multi-stage ultra in the desert. You get to run under the stars in the desert. The sand changes every day, so people think of the desert as being the same, but it isn't. It changes, the colour of the sand changes. You meet really great people. The Omani people are just beautiful, so the way you're looked after. The tents are super cool, just everything about it. And you finish, you know, at the ocean and just basically cross the finish line and then just get to walk into the ocean. And it's just, yeah, it's a really special event. I met some great people. We've got a WhatsApp group. We've all been messaging for 2 years since the last one, waiting to see each other again, from the UK and from France and Germany and Egypt. So, yeah, great people, great event, well organised, and just, I don't know, I love the heat too. So for me, being in the desert running and, I mean, soft sand is hard work, but yeah, incredible run.
How do you train for something like that when you're living in Wellington?
Foxton Beach.
Yeah.
Well, probably if you were, I'm really terrible at training. I'm one of those people that sets a goal and then about, you know, 6 weeks out goes, oh, I better do something about this. So I didn't train on sand at all. I did lots of running, trail running, but I didn't train on sand. And I don't know, it was just fine. I mean, my calves hurt, but they will after 165 kilometres. But I didn't really train. I just did lots of running, and I adapt really well to the heat, and I knew that I'd be fine with the heat because I like the heat. So that was okay. And again, I don't run to ever win anything. I run to just finish. So for me, that is winning. So I wasn't trying to, I didn't need to train to get faster or to be better. I just needed to train to be fit enough to do it. Mm. And it's self-sufficient. So you have to carry everything on your back for 6 days. So it was a lot. It was my first multi-stage self-sufficient race, but I absolutely loved it. I love the idea of being able to carry everything you need on your back. It's pretty cool.
I guess it kind of speaks to that self-sufficiency, hey?
Yeah.
Is that, people get really picky about carrying their own gear and like weigh everything down to the latest, smallest gram and everything. Was that you, or you just chuck everything and see how you go?
I didn't weigh everything. And I think I might have even messaged Suzanne when I was leaving saying that I had my jet planes and my M&Ms. So they weren't really going to fit, but I wasn't going to leave my jet planes and M&Ms behind. So I think I got rid of something else just so I could take them. And at nighttime, sitting in the tent with my 6 M&Ms was just such a treat. It was like, oh, this is so good.
So allocation a night. 60 minutes, right. Yeah. And did you go for like the sawn off toothbrush that people talk about? They cut the handles off toothbrushes and all sorts of stuff like that.
No, but I did have one of those little travel ones that was really tiny. Nice. I definitely bought into the whole tiny is good. And I think my bag was 6.9 kgs on the first day. So it's pretty tiny.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, it was good.
Wow.
I guess it's that thing, isn't it? It's between comfort and living, you know, or efficiency and not dying of starvation.
Mm.
That story about those two elite runners on the Marathon de Sable, and they basically hung around like sort of sifty, kind of like, you got any spare peanut butter? You know, they had tiny little packs and would complete and then just wait for all the mid-pack people to get there with like over-sustained packs. And, yeah.
Yeah, I can totally imagine that. I think you've got to be really committed to wanting to do really well. I didn't need to win. So therefore, I'm taking my M&Ms and my jet planes because I know that this is going to be so enjoyable. But in saying that, you're still thinking like, I don't want to carry anything more than I have to carry around for 6 days. And I hadn't run. I'd done a bit of training with a backpack on, but I didn't actually run with 7 kgs in my backpack until I got to the race.
Mm.
Yeah, and it's sort of sand shuffling. Like, let's be honest, it's not really running. It's sand shuffling. It's like shuffling along in the sand.
You mentioned the how the desert changes, which is I had never thought of that. So I'd always imagined, you know, desert races, it's like wake up in the morning, there's the desert, get home at night, still the desert. Wake up in the morning, there's the desert. So what do you mean by that? How does it change?
So the colour of the sand changes. So you can go from quite sort of light yellowy sand to almost reddish sort of sand. The light changes the way the sand looks as well. The wind creates shapes in the sand. So you see these beautiful ripples, but they're going in different directions. So that's like different textures of the way things look in front of you. There's massive dunes. The dunes are phenomenal. Like the last day is called the Big Dunes, and they were huge. And it's like climbing up a mountain, but in sand, and every foot you're slipping back down the mountain. But you feel so proud when you get to the top, and then there's another one and another one and another one and another one. Anybody who does it, honestly, the last day is really, really tough. But the views from the top of the dunes, and they are massive dunes. Like, we never see anything like it in New Zealand. Mm. I think that's the thing. It's so foreign. Mm. But yeah, the dunes create different shapes. And then there's it used to all be underwater. So you'll come to parts of the desert where there's seashells, and you know, it used to be the bottom of the ocean. Wow. So even that mind when you're out there, you're like, oh wow, this is amazing. I'm now climbing over some coral that's probably, I don't know, a billion years old or whatever. So it's pretty there's a lot to, I don't know, to keep you entertained. And then when you're running at nighttime, you can hear all sorts of noises, which is a bit freaky. And some big spiders in the desert cruising around as well. So yeah, it's definitely entertaining.
Any mountain lions?
No lions.
Oh, good.
Classic Omani understatement, isn't it? The big dunes.
They're amazing.
I've got a question for you, being that we've been asking questions. How can we make, and it's kind of, it's a big question, so we can attack it from, but like, how can we be better at making access to the sport of trail running better for young women? What can we do?
I already think it's about the introduction to it, because how many people have you interviewed that go, oh, I stumbled across it? So I guess, how do you make it more intentional, as in how do you invite young women to participate? It's expensive. Mm. Like, entry fees are expensive. And I mean, even then, you think about the length of time that we trail run for. Lots of people run for a long time, and with young women we know that time is one of the biggest barriers. So I guess it's like, if you can, is there places that it's more accessible where you could go for shorter runs? So taking young women along and introducing them, potentially starting on the flat, not starting on hills, which would be I guess another thing. Removing that financial barrier to participate. And also something that I am really conscious of is not having all the gear. So you don't want to be that person that turns up with all the gear, because then everyone goes, oh, it's, you know, you've got to have these, you've got to have poles, you know, and all these things. But actually, if you just turn up in a Holy t-shirt and some running shoes and some bike shorts, then you actually make it look accessible as well. So I think there's lots of different things, but it would definitely be about taking people and introducing them to it as a sport, because I don't think we don't see it on television, do we? So no. There's no real, it's not really visible. And I think another step is that step from trampoline. So kids that get the opportunity to go trampoline when they're young have that introduction to, you know, long distance and walking in nature, and that it's not scary. But you think about the number of young people that don't have access to camping and tramping in New Zealand. They don't even have that introductory to it. So I think there's lots of things that we could be doing differently. But I think taking a young person's hand and inviting them with you and doing a flat, accessible trail run, and at a slow pace where you can chat the whole way as well, would be a good starting place.
Mm. I mean, it has this myth of being this sort of egalitarian, classic Kiwi upbringing stuff. I'm doing air quotes now. It's a sport of privilege, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you think about it. Mm. I wonder how much, and it gets you thinking, doesn't it, about that sort of, does distance equal, and we come back to it in the sport, we come back to it on this show a lot, and we've been challenged on it. Does distance equal probity? Not necessarily.
Mm.
You know, like, are you? What makes you a true trail runner or runner?
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, because that's the thing, isn't it? The runs, the races that we will talk about and get excited about are, you know, the big ones. Maybe we need to get more excited about the Riverhead Rampages, the park runs, the 5 and 10K smaller runs that are around, but just don't get, you don't know about them. So therefore you don't do them.
Yeah, I definitely think that would be an introductory point for young people would be. And I mean, it would be benefit if there's like a waterfall or something at the end as well, because then it's actually something to see.
Right.
But you know how things like the Colour Run have really taken off. Like even now when, you know, schools are doing their cross countries now where they're making them more like obstacle courses or introducing mud runs and those sorts of things. So it's making it fun. So how do you make... And we all think trail running is super fun, but how do you make it fun for a young person? And I guess the only way you're going to figure that out is by asking them, right? So, you know, you've got to start by, and that comes back to the philosophy of shift around co-design is, if you can design something with some young people and they have a great experience, then they're more likely to want to come back and do it again. So,
I'm so glad that you loved cross country. I loved cross country, but so many people didn't at school. And I think that, And one of the reasons, I had his finger up for those
raising my hand
Zoom call. But one of the things I think about that is so often running at school equaled punishment or equaled just get out there and do it, and it was just so bad. And if we can find a way to help schools make running more fun, more, this is a good thing to do. It's not something that you're being punished with.
It's mad, it does become, you know, it can hold a real sense of fear, and it gets. I remember standing because I did the Auckland Cross Country Champs a couple of years ago, as an adult, and I remember standing on the start line of the first race, and I was running for Papakura, of course, and my coach had bought me a size too small singlet. that I'd poured myself into standing on the start line. Like I was in a bad recurring nightmare, you know, like the only thing was left was the Alsatian chain, my teeth come out. standing next to Eric Sillett, you know, Eric Sillett, and just we were both standing there on the start line, easily packing 20 kilos heavier than the guys in front, just looking at each other going, what are we doing? Then the gun went off and it was fun.
Yeah.
And it was cool. And it was like, this wasn't too bad, actually. And I didn't do too badly, even if I am, you know, pouring out of this singlet. It's so hard, isn't it? And I'm advantaged, I'm privileged, I'm a white dude. You know, like I've got the cards sort of stacked up in my favour. Just thinking about that and the lifestyle for people who don't have that privilege, it's
there's lots in the way.
There's lots in the way. And it feels systemic, though, right? It's like climate change. Like you could say, I'm not going to burn this polystyrene tray, but it's the systemic stuff that's making the difference.
Yeah, there's definitely been a shift. I mean, Sport New Zealand's shared quite a lot of, my paid job is I work at Sport New Zealand as the active recreation lead, and my volunteer job is with Shift. But Sport New Zealand's done quite a bit in the last few years to share best practice around cross country and what does it look like to create inclusive cross country experiences, quality experiences for kids. Because you can probably imagine those kids that were in your class that came last in the cross country and what a terrible experience that would have been for those kids, you know. So how do you flip that and design a cross country course that's inclusive and is fun for everybody and isn't about winning, but actually is about participation? And some schools have done an epic job of that. And I think, as we were saying before, I know some of the girls' schools around the country have introduced the Colour Run as their way of doing cross country. And it makes a huge difference to people's experience of running. And ideally, if that was the way it was right through school from the beginning of primary school, then we might see more trail runners coming out, you know, at the other end.
And it's that difference between, I mean, you can take a real cynical, and I'm sure that there may be people listening to that kind of hits a nerve. There's that whole thing about people go, oh, today it's just about, you know, you cross the road, you get a medal. But there's always going to be fast people, right? There's always going to be people who are going to win. And we should celebrate that. Like, we should celebrate people who can climb that maunga and do that. And at the same time, sport's not an exclusive club.
Why is movement so important, especially for young people?
Well, it's the foundation of. I mean, it starts with play. As the littlest person, as the little people, they learn through play, and life is play. So that is movement, and it's the way it begins, and it's, you know, brain development and cognitive function and moving all your limbs and figuring things out. And then as we get, I mean, it's interesting. It's good. Well, I think we know why it's good, but I think what's interesting is the way that we go from being able to move in a very, you think about kids on the jungle gym and how they can swing and how movement is just such this natural thing. And then they get into sport and we start taking some of that play and that really big movement out, and we start getting them to be faster or to hit things further. And it becomes, and that's when injury starts happening, because we're not no longer as flexible and as we were when we were little and we were just playing. So, I mean, that's from an injury perspective. So actually moving and play, I mean, we should be doing that our entire lives, which is the beauty of some of things like parkour and yoga, some of those movements that have been reintroduced back in, and people are doing more, and we, you know, there's less injury. But you think the opposite of that is like hockey and cricket and rugby and football, where we see mass injury. But we know that it's good for young people. It's great for their in their education, their brain, in class, their ability to concentrate. It's good for mental health. It's good for social connectedness. You learn life skills through participating and being active, and particularly in sport and team sports. So there's 100 reasons why it's good, and there's 100 reasons why it's not always offered in a quality way and not always accessible for everybody. So I mean, there's still it's to be done, but I think we deeply know the value of being being active, but there's still lots of barriers. And and I think adults can put a lot of barriers and make it not the funnest experience for young people.
Totally.
And I guess there's that sense, isn't it? And it comes back to that whole thing about how systems move slowly. I mean, there's that reasonableness that, oh, kids will play at home. And like you've probably met lots of kids who've never played, who've never had. And it's that thing, isn't it? The play is you need a safe place to play. You need resource to play. Even if it's food, you know, you need support of a parent who's available and engaged, or peer group. And then when you get to 13, 14, 15, how do you then? Oh, you're not doing PE properly.
You're absolutely right. I think play is, it's the fundamentals, and you're right that there is children in Aotearoa that don't have the time, the place, or the permission to play. And so then we see obesity and diabetes and health challenges and mental health and anxiety and all these things. And I'm not saying that movement and play is the answer to everything, because it's not. But I think when you draw it all the way back, you can sort of see how that's really important. It's a fundamental right for children to play.
Absolutely.
I was just picking up on the point about some of the about play being so important, and sort of how we push, or when I say we, kids sometimes get pushed into, oh, you're going to be a football player, and so they get pushed into specialist squads and so on. And I recently saw something from your Hutt Valley fellow person. What's the word? What's the noun I'm looking for? Anyway, Nick Willis, saying, you know, Olympic medal winner, sort of dissing that kind of thought and saying, hey, when I was a teenager, I played. And then he listed all the different things that he did. You know, he didn't go into elite running squads. That's not what made him an Olympian. What made him an Olympian was someone who enjoyed getting outside and being active and doing stuff. And that's so important.
Yeah, that's one of the sort of fundamental messages that the sport development team at Sport New Zealand is promoting through their Balance is Better mahi that they've been doing for the last couple of years, is very much about that, that early specialisation is not the answer. Young people are not going to become your next All Black or whatever through early specialisation in a specific sport. And you've, the more you do, the better. And I think they've got a number of ambassadors that share that message. And they'll be ex-Olympians as well that have, that did lots and lots of different sports and played in lots of different ways before they found their niche or the thing that they really wanted to keep going with. But yeah, it's a really important message to promote, especially to parents that think their child's going to be next, whoever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if that's right, it's parents who think that their child is going to be the next, isn't it? That's the thing. Wow. I remember running into a mother in the dairy. I'd just come back from a trial run. I think my kids are probably still asleep. They were, you know, like I was buying the paper and she's like, oh, just in between, you know, going to field hockey, I don't know what it was, lacrosse, something else, you know, rugby, football, rugby league. Is it your Saturdays like that? I was like, we've never, ever done that, ever. Like, we've never, we have no, I don't know it's because I was a shift worker or, you know, it just wasn't our experience, but it hasn't seemed to have harmed our kids at all, you know. And I'm sure that, I'm not dissing that at all.
Yeah.
But, man, it's hectic, right? It's a lot to fit in for a family already. And there's lots of positives with that, right? Community, engage, you know, community engagement, club. That kind of whānau, the whanaunga kind of stuff, but the other side of it is, you're very unlikely to be the next, I don't know, Gemma McCaw or the next Dan Carter, right?
Like,
even statistically.
Hey, this past year, of course, there's been the added pressure of a global pandemic and lockdowns and all those things, but you didn't kind of sit around just thinking, "Well, was me." Damn COVID. You actually went and ran the Lower North Island just because? Tell us about that.
So I had planned to go to the Middle East, to go to Egypt and do a run. I'd also planned to go to Sri Lanka last year and do the Ultra X Sri Lanka. So I'd had two kind of overseas runs planned, so holiday and a run. And then COVID. And so I thought, well, there's not any really, you know, any multi-stage races that I want that are coming up that I can do. So maybe I'll just plan my own. So then I just planned my own. So I just got Google Maps out and was like, oh, people have been talking about, you know, the run to the Bridge to Nowhere. And and so I'd been like, oh, that could be, maybe I could just start there and that could be the first leg. And then, oh, what if I did this? And then what if I did that? And I mapped it out. And it was about 300 kilometres back to Upper Hutt. And I thought that's probably a bit far with minimal training as per usual, and then working basically two jobs. So I roped in the Sport New Zealand graduate last year, Brittany, as my support crew, and she had a van with bed in it. So she was like, yeah, I'll support you for 5 days. So we just came up with a random, random run and started in the Whanganui National Park, and then few driving bits in between, but just made my way back to Upper Hutt over 5 days. So camping at night and then doing a run the next day. And I think my longest day was about 53 kilometres and my shortest day was about 35, I think. So, a bit of a mixed bag, but just a lot of fun. And I was using it as a fundraiser for Shift as well. So we raised some money for the Shift Foundation while I was running along. But good adventures, really fun. We had a workmate come out and do a day with us and he got the van stuck in the water and ate lots of pasta and had a few beers in the evening and found some great camping spots along the Whanganui River. And, it was just an epic adventure and lots of fun.
Isn't that what it's all about?
It is, for me, it definitely is. It's about positive mental health and just about getting out in nature and, I don't know, it's just my chosen physical activity. I love it.
Yeah. But sometimes you do go in conventional races, like you did the Old Ghost Ultra this year. This year, losing track of the months. But you got stung there.
I did. It was a bit of a disaster. It wasn't actually. It was. So if you haven't done it, you have to do it. It's absolutely the coolest run. And the event directors and the whole team behind it are just incredible. And the race briefing was the best one I've ever been to. It was so inspiring and great and funny and just brilliant. And they warned us and said that there's wasps on the trail and we've done our best to get rid of them. And it's kind of like, oh, yeah, whatever. Little did I know that I'm allergic to wasps or to Yeah, so I actually got the only other time I've been stung was in Mexico, and I got stung by a bee. But I thought that the whole reason my foot swelled up and looked like a sausage was because of the bees drink from the cactus. And I was like, oh, it's like tequila, mesculine toxicity, and that's what's wrong, and that's why my foot's blown up. I didn't actually think, oh, I'm allergic. And so this is the first time I've been stung in New Zealand. So I got stung on my left ankle about 15K in, so quite early.
Yeah.
And it was fine. It really hurt when it stung, and I pulled it went into the top of my shoe, and so I pulled it out and was just running on and just being like, this is a bit sore. And then after about 5 minutes, the sting kind of went away and it was fine. And then I changed shoes at the halfway mark, and I took my changed shoes and socks. And when I took my sock off, I was like, oh, this is not looking too good. And it was sort of a little bit swollen. And then I headed off on the next bit, which was all uphill. And I got to the final aid station. So that must be, I don't know, what is it, like 15 or 18 kilometres from the end. And I sat down and I looked at my ankle. It was double. My other ankle. And so I got my poles out because I was like, oh, this is going to be a long 15 kilometres. And it was. I had tears, and I was on my own, and it was really hard going and really painful. And I think my tendon had just got so swollen and agitated from the swelling that moving my ankle just hurt. So every step was painful. But weirdly, it got to the last 3 kilometres and I ran the last 3 kilometres. So your brain is incredible how, you know, you've limped along and it's all so painful. And then I ran the last 3 and it was great. So I was about an hour and a half longer than I was expecting. I was aiming for 12 hours and I was just over 13 and a half. So I was a little bit disappointed because I had set myself a goal. But also, yeah, just the most epic run. So I absolutely loved it and I definitely want to do it again next year.
Everyone who...
Yeah, it seems like we're being set up and every single guest is just here to taunt us about Old Ghost Ultra and the fact that we haven't done it.
Yeah,
and
you had the chance to, but you didn't. You stupids. Yeah.
But correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not the nurse in this conversation, nurse. But yes. I don't think running an ultra is in the textbook of what you should do when you've had a sting, like how to prevent the poison getting around your body, is it?
Look, I have had a similar experience in Old Mother Riverhead where they do medicinal honey and they...
Ah, yeah.
They and the helicopter clearing, they had 50 or 60 beehives, and I came out of the a side thing.
Trail.
Through, got sort of a little bit way through and thought, oh dear, there's no way around, and just decided to kind of keep going. And I got stung, I think, 5 or 6 times.
Ooh.
And kept running, and when what do? You run faster. And I got out, and my heart rate was about 186, and my tongue was starting to swell.
Oh, no.
So I think you did the right thing, because, like, what are you going to do? I mean...
Well, exactly. Yeah. What are the options? Get helicoptered, literally.
Exactly, bang your EPIRB, let's go. Yeah. Maybe Wellington Softy gets helicoptered off mountain.
I know, I wouldn't have been able to live with myself. Very much. So.
As a person who has been helicoptered off a mountain for not very much, Yeah.
Hey, you got a trip to Macago.
I got a trip to Macago. It's not a good story. That's the thing, though. What a good story.
Yeah.
What a good story.
Yeah,
did it come right? Like, the swelling went down eventually, or?
Then I was like, I think I'm allergic. So then I started taking some antihistamines the next day, and that definitely helped. Yeah, it's taken, I've only just started, so I've pretty much had 5 weeks with minimal running, and it's actually only just feeling like I can completely move it again without the tendon being a bit sore, so I definitely damaged the tendon. It seems all good now.
I did just think of something. I mean, Phil Rossiter does some amazing things at that race. Are you sure he hadn't fed the wasps tequila? Maybe it still is. It could still be
totally
that.
He totally could have.
It could still be that.
What an incredible man. He is just something else. He really, it's just so inspirational. And they actually give you the book that tells the story of the creation of Old Ghost Road or race. And I read it started reading it that night. I fell asleep reading it. But what a magic story.
Yeah. Just incredible. Incredible, isn't it? Yeah.
Quite iconoclastic people, isn't it? It's so easy. And I guess it's the same thing. It takes it back to the start of what we were talking about. It's so easy and lazy to pigeonhole people into, you know, West Coast. Okay, so those type of people live in the West Coast. Oh, Lower Hutt. Those type of people live in the Lower Hutt. And those type of people fall off the rails or whatever.
Mm.
But I guess it's the thing, isn't it? We're, it keeps coming back. It's multifactorial.
Mm. Yeah, for sure.
What do you hope for Shift Foundation?
That one day it's financially viable and sustainable. So we've been going for 5 years. This year will be our fifth birthday, and every year is a struggle. Like most charities in New Zealand, I know we're not unique. But I guess that's the goal. So it's never to me been about, you know, scaling, or people have, you know, often ask like, oh, where will you go next, or where do you want to go? And it's like, well, that's not really how it works. Like, firstly, I think it's really important that you're invited into communities. You don't just decide that you're going to go plonk your idea into someone else's community. I think just creating a model where we're more financially sustainable is the goal. That just takes time and thinking, and we're working on it. The board's great. We'll see. But that's just, really to support as many young women as we possibly can to meet the demand that we have for the programs and services that we offer. Mm. To still be around in 10 years, but then also wouldn't it be magic if we weren't around because all young women were flourishing and there was no need for, charity Shift supporting young women's well-being. So I kind of say that, like, wouldn't it be great, but then on the same hand. So I don't know, just keep doing what we're doing and hope that we're making a difference in the lives of young women.
How can people help with that?
It certainly fills my cup.
How can people help with that?
Well, you can go to the Shift website and make a donation. So shiftnz.org is the Shift website, and there's a option I think at the top that says donate, so you can make a donation. All donations go directly to the programs and services that we run for young women. It's not like they go to pay my volunteer salary. Otherwise, just follow us on social media and see what we're about. So at Shift Foundation NZ on Instagram and Facebook.
Cool.
You see lots of amazing photos of lots of incredible Wellington young women doing epic shit.
Cool. All right. Well, we are going to ask you the question that, having listened to previous episodes, you know is coming. So I hope you're prepared. But Fran McKeown, what is your greatest run ever?
Well, I'm not prepared. But let's go with the uncreatively named Oman Desert Ultra. 2019, and I would really love to go back and do it. And I hope that, talking a little bit about it, that I've maybe inspired other people to look at it as a really great desert run, something different, a bit off the beaten track and not one of the popular desert runs, but absolutely an incredible experience.
Brilliant.
Fantastic. Look, thank you for coming on Dirt Church Radio. Thank you for the work that you do, both in your pay job and your volunteer role and the service that you provide. And thank you, Fran. It's been really, really lovely having you on.
Thank you. It's been a real it's been a real pleasure and a privilege talking to you both.
Thank you so much.
She's incredible.
She is. She really is. So she referenced Suzanne there. That's Suzanne McFadden, who's been badgering us for ages to get Fran on, and I'm so glad we finally did.
Yeah, when you told her tonight, it wasn't so much, her reply was just a sort of a weary satisfaction.
It was.
It was a preemptive, I told you so.
At last you guys listened to me. Yeah.
Look, thank you, Fran.
For an amazing conversation.
Thank you for and your kaupapa and your manaakitanga and everything that you do for the people that you serve. And thank you very much for tuning in. We're on social media at Dirt Church Radio, and you can email us at dirtchurchradio@gmail.com. You can find us on all the podcast platforms. Like and subscribe if you fancy, and you can download direct from the website, which is dirtchurchradio.com.
Don't forget to write in with your greatest run ever. We love hearing from you, and you can read them on the website as well, and we can see that plenty of people do that.
And thanks to our supporters, Scott Running, Further Faster, Spring Energy, and Cielly. Thank you to our Patreon patrons, and thank you, Wild Things. Thank you to our editor, Kieran. And we've got a live show on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
So tune in next week, and ka kite anō.
Ka kite anō. Thanks, Rigby.